Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to the 173rd session. That seems kind of odd, but number 173 of the Sunstone Symposium for the Salt Lake City. The panel discussion today is entitled "The Smoke Still Lingers: The Mark Hoffman Affair 15 Years Later." I'm the chair and panelist, Steve Mayfield, and with me today are Brent Ashworth. Brent right here with the red tie, you can't miss him. Brent is a collector of some of the Hoffman material and has had personal tragedies in his life due to Mark Hoffman that he may share with us. Next to him is the most wonderful man in the world, a man who I worship and adore. His name is George Throckmorton, and I say that because he is my boss. And my yearly evaluation is coming up soon. So anyway, George is a forensic document and handwriting scientist, I guess, or expert. He's also director of the Salt Lake Police Crime Lab, where I'm employed as well. Our discussion today on Mark Hoffman isn't to go over things that happened 15, 20 years ago. We could spend hours and hours regurgitating all those things written and said and done. Our emphasis today will be on what has happened since the time the handcuffs were placed on Mr. Hoffman and he was led off to the point of the mountain. The question we have is, have we learned anything from this incident? We want to talk about what has happened to the document business, those who collect it, those who sell them, those who buy them, the effect it's had on research, and what we can learn from it. I want to mention that our third panelist is to be Kirk Bench, and maybe you've heard Kirk unfortunately came down with something unexpectedly, had to have an operation. I'm sure all things considered, Kirk would rather be here than in the hospital, but we do wish him well, he and his family, and hope for a quick recovery, and maybe another time he can share his experiences and knowledge on the case. I want to begin to start off. Now, I'm almost nervous to see if anybody, I assume that everybody here knows what who Mark Hoffman is and what it's about. I'm almost tempted to ask if nobody does. It's almost like asking somebody, where were you when they landed on the moon, or where were you when President Kennedy was assassinated? Everybody generally knows who, what, where, how, and why when that happened. And over the years, everybody has an experience or something they've heard or seen. We have found that in law enforcement, nobody just develops something or commits a crime and then it goes away. You can pretty well count that while Mr. Hoffman whiles his time away behind bars, there's somebody else out in the world who is studying this case and learning from his mistakes. Mr. Throckmorton has told me many times that Mark Hoffman is the greatest forger we ever caught. Recently, a book was published this year, if I can pull it out here. A little show and tell here, called Practice to Deceive, written by Joseph Rosenblum, by Oak Knoll Press, publishes here, in which he gives about 9 chapters on historical forgers. 8 of those people are in the paths of all deceased. 1 living person. Can we guess who that is? Okay, he's right there in the corner. That's how much the impact this man had. Another interesting aspect is the fact that Mark just didn't deal with one topic. A lot of forgers have a tendency to deal with one person or one subject. Mark hit the whole gamut. Just not Mormonism, Americana. Following his removal to the state prison, there was an attempted suicide by him. And it's questioned whether he was really trying to commit suicide or get attention or what. But as he was in the hospital being checked out, authorities at the state prison checked his cell out, what we'll call shakedown or search of the cell. And they came up with a document that he had written. And he'd written on the top, famous people who I have forged. On one top side was all Mormon characters. On the other side were Americana, famous Americans. And those who looked at it, who knew about his case, said there are some names on here that we've never seen documents for. There are documents out there that we do not know of. And I think George will share with some that in the last year that we've come across. And so will Brent. So actually, I'd like to turn it over to whoever wants to go first to talk about Mr. Hoffman and his forgeries. And then we get down to the question and answer period. We can discuss what we as a community could learn from and what we can do so it might not happen again. So who wants to go first? This is Mr. Throckmorton.
Can I ask the question Steve didn't ask? How many here do not know about Mark Hoffman? One person? Two people? Okay. On the very back, standing up, can you hear me? Okay. Raise your hand if you cannot hear me. We'll try. Is that a little better? Steve asked me if I would participate in this, and I told him I would. I want to take just a couple of minutes and tell you a few things, and then it won't take long, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And my understanding was, is I'll just sit here, and if anybody has any questions, I'll do my best to answer them. But I started out in law enforcement over 32 years ago up in Ogden. People always ask me, how did I ever get into this to begin with? Well, that's how I started out. I was with the Ogden Police Department. And while I was up there, I started, as crimes occurred and the crime laboratory would come to the scene, I got intrigued by what they did and what they could do. And as a result of that, I made my wishes known that I wanted to work in the crime lab, and so they started giving me things to read and told me what schooling to get and so forth, and eventually I got in the crime lab in Ogden. During that time, I was attending school at Weber State, getting a degree in criminal justice. It was called police science back then. It was called Weber State College back then, too. And then I left, and I went up to Washington State University and got my master's degree up there in police science with an emphasis in criminalistics, which is the scientific examination of physical evidence. Upon coming back to Utah, I found that I was overeducated and over-experienced as far as getting a job and couldn't get the job I wanted because of various circumstances. But we were literally forced to move to Salt Lake because although I was born here, we left, my wife and I did, and we never wanted to come back. But because of the employment situation, we were literally forced to come back here. And I, for several years, worked at the LDS Hospital and as director of safety and security up there. When the crime laboratory was officially started in Utah, I became their first person that was employed there, and I was employed as a document examiner. As a result of that, my employment, I wanted to get some additional training and contacted a fellow in Phoenix, Arizona, because he happened to be the president of one of the associations, the International Association for Identification. He was the president of the questioned document section, and that means simply any document that there's a question whether it's authentic or not. So I called him on the phone, and he said, come on down and visit us. And as I went down to Phoenix to work with him for a period of time, I met three people who I greatly admire. One of them is an individual by the name of Bill Flynn. And if any of you follow the Hoffman case at all, you'll realize the significance of Bill Flynn in what I'm saying. If you don't, buy the book and read it. It wouldn't have happened without him. And, in fact, it was some 7, 8 years later, I guess, when he finally got involved in the case also. But I worked at the State Crime Laboratory for several years, and because of circumstances, I didn't like it. And so I applied for and got a job at the Attorney General's office as an investigator of white-collar crime. The advantage of an investigator for the Attorney General's office is one of our responsibilities is to assist local law enforcement agencies in complicated and complex crimes. And it was while I was working for the Attorney General's office that we had bombs exploding in Salt Lake. And after about 6 weeks later or so forth, I was assigned to assist the county attorney's office and the Salt Lake Police Department in doing the investigation. That's how I got involved in the Hoffman case. And for 16 months, there were 11 of us that was working full-time on that investigation. It's the longest investigation in the United States history on any forgery fraud case. When Mark Hoffman eventually pled guilty in 1987, I really and sincerely thought the case was over. In fact, when the Attorney General said I could go down and assist with the case, he thought I would be there for about 2 weeks. Little did he know it was going to be 16 months. And when Bill Flynn from Phoenix, when I asked him to help me on the case, he thought he would be up here and out in about 2 weeks. Little did he know it was going to be very time-consuming for the next year and a half. But one thing I found during this investigation, and believe it or not, this year it'll have been 15 years ago that this happened, and as I teach a class for the community college, I ask the students if they've heard of this, and very rare do they ever know what I'm talking about. So I can tell how old you people are now. And that's okay, because I'm up there too. I've got a little note on my wall at work, and it says, researchers generally find what they're looking for, whether it's there or not. And I firmly believe that. And I've also noticed that over the years as I've talked to various groups about the investigation involved in this and so forth, that some people have a tendency to hang on to every word I say. And why they do it, I don't know. I can only speculate because they happen to hear something that reinforces their own personal belief. And they'll come up to me 6 months later and says, remember when you said this? And I don't remember. And you can ask Steve. I don't remember from one day to the next what I say half the time. I look at it and say, if I don't lie, I don't have to worry about what I say. But what I've noticed is I do have a tendency to forget times and dates. And so frequently I'll say, yeah, I spoke with you in February. And they'll say, no, it was actually March the 2nd. And therefore I'm lying. And if I'm lying here, I must be lying elsewhere. Well, the reason I say that is I don't want you to think that I'm a prophet, because I'm not a prophet. And believe me, science is not perfect. And if there's any scientist here that thinks it is, please talk with me, because this investigation disproved every scientific principle that was presently embraced throughout the world. Mark Hoffman was actually that good. And the way he was caught was the way that all white-collar criminals are caught, through repetition and through making stupid, minor mistakes. And all I had to do, quite frankly, is sit back and wait for 16 months until he made enough of these stupid, minor mistakes, and then we can put them all together and eventually come to the conclusion we did. To my knowledge, there's only three people in the world today that know how he did his forgeries, and I'm intrigued as people come up. They say, oh, yeah, I took this to somebody else to examine it, and they said they think it's genuine and so forth. But the techniques that Mark Hoffman used, it took Bill Flynn and myself over 6 months to learn how he did them. And we were wrong. But within the next 6 months, we found out our errors and we corrected it. So in effect, it took about a year to find out how he made his forgeries and how he fooled science today. And I've said it before, if you were to examine some of these documents in 20 years, they'll tell you they're genuine documents. That's how good he was. We caught them on some very stupid mistakes. But anyway, as I said, to my knowledge, there's only three people. Bill Flynn is one in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm the second one, and the third one is presently residing at the state penitentiary. And hopefully he'll be there for some time to come. As a result of that, I've examined many documents over the years. During the investigation, I examined over 600 documents that came through the hands of Mark Hoffman. Although many of them were genuine, there wasn't one of them that was worth any value historically or monetarily that he hadn't altered. In other words, everything that came through his hand was forged. And that still is the case today. Since he went behind bars, I figured it out. I've examined over 50 documents since 1987. That's roughly three a year. This year, I've examined five documents, of which four of them I never even knew existed. I've examined a Bible, a New Testament, with his signature in the front. I've examined a first edition of the Book of Mormon with his signature in the front. In fact, I examined another first edition, just because I was curious, with his signature in the front. And to date, as far as I know, and in talking to the other people, there's not a single book that has his signature in the front of it. If any of you here know one, I would like to see it out of curiosity, if nothing else. Joseph Smith's signature, I'm sorry, the signature of Joseph Smith. Because miraculously, what would happen is a first edition of a Book of Mormon would be purchased by Mark from somebody, Mark Hoffman. He would sell it to somebody else. But suddenly a signature of Joseph Smith would show up in there. Or a first edition of, can't think of that one, Jack London wrote it, the first edition of the book he wrote.
Call of the Wild.
First edition, and yet miraculously when Mark sold it, it had an autograph of Jack London in there. Or an autograph of Brigham Young. And this is typically what he would do. He would get genuine documents from various sources, and he would add a name which would increase the value anywhere up to $10,000 more than what he paid for it. As recent as a month ago, I examined a first edition Book of Mormon out of Providence, Rhode Island, that had a signature of Joseph Smith in it, but it was not his. It was another forgery. The only reason I say this is, of the 50 documents, and I can't, as I thought, Steve asked me if I could bring some Xerox copies of some of these documents to show you, and I thought I would, but then as I was thinking about it, I thought I wouldn't. Because as I do work for people, it's on a confidential basis. And if they wanted that information out, they can put it out. I won't. But I can speak generically to you. And over the years, I found this profession of historical collecting, and I hope not to offend anybody unless they deserve it. I mean, if the shoe fits, wear it. I find it to be one of the most corrupt professions there is in the entire United States, next to sports memorabilia. I've been working sports memorabilia for over 15 years, and I've only seen one genuine document. Everything else has been forged, whether it's on a baseball, a basketball, letters, or whatever. We came across an individual that was putting out approximately 500 forgeries a day on baseball cards and had been for the last 3 months before the FBI finally moved in on him. I examined a Babe Ruth jersey, which had been forged, and they were planning on selling it for $500,000 in San Francisco. Is there money involved in this? Absolutely there is. And the problem is, frequently it costs more money to examine it than the document may be worth, especially historical documents. One of the great things that Mark Hoffman knew, as he was a manipulator of people, and realizing that it's going to cost anywhere from $400 to maybe $2,000 or $3,000. In fact, I know of one document they charged over $7,000 to examine, and they were wrong in their examination. The average person doesn't want to spend, say, $500 for an autograph of Brigham Young and then bring it to me and I say, hey, guess what? You just bought a forgery. It's not worth that much money. And then in spite of that, they still have to pay me my $500 or $600 or $700. So people don't want to do that. And Mark Hoffman made a statement once. He said, I'm not doing anything wrong. He says, I'm only giving people what they want. And if they think it's genuine, that's good. They're happy. And I've almost embraced that theory. It's awful. I had the distinct privilege during this investigation of coming in and telling an individual that he had just spent $425,000 on a forged document. He wasn't happy. He took it out on me. Okay? So I'm happy if ever I find a genuine document, which means I'm a very sad person because I don't see many genuine documents. This has not stopped with the incarceration of Mark Hoffman. As I said, in the past 15 years, I've examined over 50 of them, and only 8 of them were genuine. All the rest were forged. They used the typical same process that Mark Hoffman developed. We believe he developed them because we found them no place else except through him. And although he is locked away, his legacy goes on, I guess, and continues to go on. I thought this would be a quick experience, and it's been going on for 15 years. And at this point, and I've spoken, by the way, from Washington, D.C. to California. I've spoken to as few as 7 people and as many as 17,000 people on this story. I've spent as short as 15 minutes and as long as 3 whole days discussing what he did. And quite frankly, I'm bored. But I do this because I think I have a certain obligation, and that's the only reason I'm doing it, is because there are forgeries out there still. They are resurrecting themselves the second time around. Within the past year and a half, we found documents that I examined 15 years ago and told they were forged. They are now coming up again as genuine documents. I found one instance where my report, they had a copy of my report, which said it was genuine, except they only had one paragraph, and the word genuine was not incorporated in that paragraph. And if they had had the other 2 paragraphs, they would have found out that I said it was actually forged, not a genuine document. So I know that many of the dealers are not honest in what they do. If I can give any suggestion for you, all I can say is get one as cheap as you can because it's probably forged, so it doesn't matter anyway. Okay? But I'll turn the time over here to Brent Ashworth. He'll have some interesting things to say, and later on, if you have any questions of me, I'll try and answer them. Thank you.
Well, thanks, George. Appreciate that enlightenment, as always. And as a collector and someone who's been collecting for many decades, I've got to say that there are genuine documents out there. I don't know of any that came through Mark Hoffman. So I have to agree 100% with George on that. Incidentally, we were asked to speak primarily about events that have happened since the Hoffman thing, and I'm going to try to direct my comments to that. I should say that I had quite a bit of involvement with him prior to the time he went to prison and purchased a number of documents from him, which later proved to be forgeries. And I think I was among the first that volunteered those to George. In fact, he told me one of my documents was so poorly done, one I had requested. I said to Mark one day, I said, if you ever get a letter from Joseph Smith from Carthage Jail, I want it. And within 2 months, he had miraculously found such a letter. Unfortunately, he sold it to someone else in Arizona, and I was livid over that. And I went to Mark's house, pounded on his front door till he came to the front door, came in and really kind of poured my soul out a bit on that. Said, look, you promised to sell that to me if you came up with one. You set a price, and you sold it for $10,000 less to this fellow in Arizona, and I want to know why. And at any rate, I kind of laid into him on that evening. And as I got up to leave, he just kind of stared at me, and he says, Brent, come on back. Get it off your chest. And he says, you'll feel a lot better. And I says, Mark, I just got it off my chest, and I feel a whole lot worse. And as I left his home that evening, I remember thinking as I passed the point of the mountain, that's where Mark Hoffman belongs. Needless to say, I did not know his documents were forgeries at that time. A year or so later, I guess it was 2 or 3 years later, that's where he ended up, because that was in 84. Anyway, that's all I'll say about that, except that that I lost a great deal of money and other things as a result of that. And I felt like that as a collector and someone that is interested in history and is interested in authentic documents, which our country's history and our church's history is based on authentic documents. So not every document is forged. Just the ones from Mark Hoffman and from his compatriots that are forgers. And from that forger who hasn't been caught, I guess we owe it a duty to try to catch him or her. But at any rate, I felt that it was one of my duties as a collector and someone that had been involved with this, try to do what I could to get the Hoffman forgeries off the market, since I deal more directly with the manuscript market than a number of other people have. Well, I was minding my own business, one example, and reading my catalog from Sotheby's on May 19, 1997, when I opened it up, and lo and behold, I saw a Daniel Boone item. And I looked at this and I thought, I've seen this before. In fact, I wrote in the margin, Hoffman, ? And then as I got into the catalog a little further, I saw something even more amazing. I saw a reward of merit from the Revolutionary War period, 1774, signed by Nathan Hale. And I says, aha, I have found some of Mark's things in Sotheby's. Well, turned out I called a friend of mine at Sotheby's, and I told him that you've got two items in your catalog, May 19th, 97 catalog, that are Mark Hoffman forgeries, which at one time came from a dealer in Nevada. I named the dealer, and I knew that that dealer had been one that had not cooperated much with the authorities here in Utah as they were putting the case together, and I knew he still had a bunch of forgeries. And so, anyway, I was a little put off by the response I got, even though this was a longtime friend of Sotheby's. He just said, well, thanks for that information. We'll look into it. But they went ahead with the sale. They did pull the Boone item, but they the other item, the Nathan Hale piece, sold for $31,050. And frankly, I was totally amazed. I called back and said, what'd you go ahead with that sale for? I told you those came from Hoffman. And they gave me this cock and bull story about Ken Rendell, one of the people who actually got quite duped on the Hoffman thing. He wrote the letter of authenticity on the Salamander letter, those of you that remember the case. But he'd had some amount of fame from having uncovered the Hitler journals as being fakes. You remember that, the Der Stern $4 million they paid for Hitler journals back in the early 80s? Unfortunately, he was duped by Hoffman, too, and had written the letter of authenticity on the Salamander letter, which Steve Christensen had at the time it was presented to the church. Any rate.
Can I interject something?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Is this on?
I want to interject something. He just told me something I didn't know about, and I don't know whether he knows about it. That Daniel Boone letter? I was asked in 1992 by an auction house, which I will not mention because I don't have the catalog to prove it, if I would examine that letter, and I examined that letter and said it was a forgery. 3 months later, I got a call from a guy who bought it for $30,000 and said, would you examine a letter I just bought from Daniel Boone, or by him? And I inquired a little bit, and I says, I think there's a conflict of interest, so I referred him down to Bill Flynn in Phoenix. Bill examined it. He said it's a forgery, so the guy went back, and they gave him his money back. Later on, I started getting involved with some of the attorneys, and if there's an attorney here, you'll be able to understand what I'm saying. I said, I thought you guaranteed these. They said, we do. We guarantee that if you don't like them, we'll give you your money back. But we do not guarantee that they're authentic. And that is why they continue to sell them, even though they know they're forged. I had no idea. That was 1997. Mm-hmm. So that one's still going around. Has anybody bought it recently? Okay. Did you?
Sorry, man. Go ahead.
Sure, that's fine. Well, that wasn't the end of the story, because Sotheby's put out another catalog the next month. This is June 3rd, 97. And this was a friend of mine again. I called back there. He's actually the head of the books and manuscripts department. And I said, well, you've really done it this time. I said, you've got a poem of Emily Dickinson. I know you can't see this, but I said, the last time I saw that, Hoffman offered it to me in his living room of his home for $10,000 in 1984. And I said, frankly, even though the handwriting looked good to me, it was in pencil, incidentally, and I still think there's no tests, are there, directly for pencil? So it's in pencil. Some of Hoffman's forgeries you haven't heard a whole lot about are in pencil. And I bought a bunch of those. In fact, I got a few of those. But I think it's, again, a duty to get those off the market. And this poem was written supposedly by Emily Dickinson. It was one of the poorest poems I'd ever read. And when I first can speak with a slight authority because I've been president of the Emily Dickinson Society of Utah for 2 years, and but I had not been at that time. But I was a big fan of her poetry, and I knew that her poetry is extremely rare. Many of you know that her poems were not famous until after her death. And I think there were a total of 6 or 7 published during her lifetime, only one of which was in a book, and that wasn't published with her knowledge. A friend had sent it off to the publisher to be published. Many people thought that poem was by Emerson when it came out. But at any rate, it wasn't until after her death that her sister Lavinia found that there were 1,775 poems in her dresser drawer, and they were tied together in facets. And were little groups with needle and thread and string. And some of them were later pulled apart. And a great Emily Dickinson expert, Dr. Ralph Franklin, who's still living, is at the library, the Beneke Library at Yale, is the authority, living authority, on Emily Dickinson. He reconstructed all these facets a few years ago and published a photographic guide of each one in order. Did really a life's work, many, many years of doing that. Well, I was told when I called my friend at Sotheby's that they'd already checked this out. They'd gone to Dr. Franklin with it, and Dr. Franklin was going to include it in his all-comprehensive lifelong work that he was about to come out with, a multi-volume long of all of Emily's known poems. And this was the newly discovered one that would be in that anthology. And I said I can't tell you if it's a fake. That's not my business. That's George's. But I can tell you that it was offered to me by Mark Hoffman, and I remember the content of it. And it was one of the poorest poems of hers, if she wrote it, that I ever heard. So I was pretty sure later that it was of Mark's work, even though it was in pencil. And I says, I think you really need to check it out with someone else. Well, they claimed that Ken Rendell had looked at this piece as well as the other two pieces I mentioned in the prior catalog. And I even knew that I'd seen this piece framed up on the walls of the Museum of Historical Documents in Las Vegas, Nevada. And later I saw it in one of their other galleries in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. And I said, well, I think it's a fake. That's my opinion. I'm not an expert on that, but I do know what Mark presented to me to buy, and that was one of those pieces. So I really think you should check it out. Well, they went ahead with the sale. And I found out later that the Jones Library, the little library in Amherst, where Emily Dickinson was from, where she's buried, where she lived out her life in the home there in her little bedroom, that the library there, headed by Dan Lombardo, who was the head of the Jones Library at the time, they had actually got the International Emily Dickinson Society and students across the state to gather pennies, nickels, and dimes to go to auction to buy this thing. And he had raised just the amount of money that it went for, basically, the $21,150 plus the fee to the auction house. Well, I was talking with another dealer back in New York. I told him my misgivings on these three pieces, only one of which they'd pulled, and that was the Daniel Boone from the previous catalog. And I guess he got talking with Dr. Franklin, whom he knew. And then next thing I knew, I got a call from Ralph Franklin, the world's authority on Emily Dickinson, because he's about to put this in his anthology as a newly discovered poem of Emily Dickinson. I says, Ralph, I got acquainted with him very, very quickly, as we exchanged a lot of phone calls there. I said, Ralph, did you really look at the content of that poem, despite the fact that, that you like the handwriting like I did when I first saw it? Did you read the content? He says, well, of course I did. He says, I thought it was a little off the wall. I says, well, off the wall, it's you find another poem of hers where she is so negative about things. And at any rate, he started to question the document. And from that point on, a number of people got involved with it, including Jennifer Larson, who's made it a long-time work to try to help get the Hoffman fakes off the market. And I was exchanging calls rather regularly with Lombardo and with Franklin and then later with Jennifer. It was determined, of course, that this was a Hoffman forgery. And it caused quite a stir, mostly because of the point that Sotheby's had been warned both times. That I called them both times ahead of the sale and told them that they had Hoffman originals coming up for sale, or probable Hoffman originals. And they went ahead with the sales anyway, except for pulling the Boone item. And one item got over $30,000 and the other over $24,000. Well, if you can imagine poor Mr. Lombardo at the Little Jones Library, how he felt. He thought he was going to lose his job. He thought, this is the worst thing that could ever happen to him. Of course, he wasn't acquainted with the fallout from Hoffman. That was just a microcosm of what some of us went through in the 80s. But I tried to reassure him that the best thing that could be done at this point in time is to make sure that we prove to everybody's satisfaction that it was a fake and that we get it out of circulation and that the library get their money back. Well, they did have a little difficult time getting their money back, believe it or not, until he held a press conference at the Jones Library and announced that it was a forgery. They'd taken it to experts, and more importantly than that, that it did have a history. And then Mr. Lombardo had written to Hoffman at the state prison, and Hoffman essentially wrote back a letter to him saying, well, of course it was a forgery. I thought everybody knew that was a forgery. And that's basically the way his letter went.
Again, I examined that in the summer of 1988 and determined that was a forgery for an individual in Chicago. I had no idea what was going on until... Thank you, Brent. So there was a written report out there on that in 1988. I don't know what happened to it.
Well, the report didn't stick with the document, obviously. And there are still Hoffman fakes out there. George has already said that. And I'm finding, though, that more and more, I was aware of the Book of Mormons. There are two that I'm aware of that Mark signed Joseph Smith. One of them I owned at one time, and the other one was this with his friend back in Rhode Island. Except the friend in Rhode Island thought his was genuine for many years, and so I'm glad to know that he finally got it into you to look at. Because the more we can do to get these things out of circulation, I think the more we can do to clean up this area of the market. Many of you know that Hoffman had started on the national market, kind of a secondary feature. He'd done mostly Mormon autographs. But then he started on doing people like Daniel Boone and Paul Revere. I remember one time going to his home, and sorry for the drawback, but that period, but seeing a Paul Revere item, and I thought it looked so good later, I thought the ink hadn't dried on it yet. And, of course, it was proven that was in fact, the case, that the ink hadn't dried yet. And that's probably why he didn't sell it to me. He just showed it to me from, 5 feet away. But, anyway, it's comical in that sense until you realize that this guy was not just a forger. He was a murderer. And he killed people. And he disrupted lives of many others. And so... I think we've got a duty to try to get these forgeries off the market. If for no other reason, I happen to love our church history, and I happen to love United States history and world history, and I want to make sure that we kind of get these items that sort of contaminate what we've got on there out of there. Incidentally, Dr. Franklin did come out with his three-volume anthology, and it has a nice little footnote in there about our getting that piece off the market. So I'm grateful for that. I guess that's all I got. Oh, incidentally, if you want to read about that, there's the Emily Dickinson thing was written by a... There was an article by a Mr. Worrell. His name. Simon Worrell. It's entitled, Emily Dickinson Goes to Las Vegas. And it's a very entertaining article, and it was published in an unusual little... called the Paris Review, a literary poetry thing. And then there was a news release recently saying that there's a Hollywood producer looking at the story to possibly make it into a motion picture again. So we're looking at another possible angle for a Hoffman film. So far, those have all been killed, luckily, and I hope this one is too. Thanks.
George told me one time that if they ever made a movie, he was holding out for Clint Eastwood to play your part, right? go ahead, make my forgery. Oh, no. Anyway, before we turn over to some questions and answers from you folks, I thought I'd fill you in on what has happened to Mark since he, again, went away. I found over the little last few weeks as I've made some phone calls and talked to people about it, the question comes up, what is Mark doing down at the prison? Yeah, doing a lot of writing. Mark, so I took the opportunity to talk to a few people that I work with in the police department who have been prison guards there, who worked with Mark, and then I got real brave and I called Jack Ford, who's a public relations press man for the state prison system, Department of Corrections. And when I told him who I was and what, of course, I threw George's name out there, so, you know, oh yeah, I'll tell you everything. And but he just really just kind of flowed with it. First of all, the big secret, that's not a secret, but people hear it. Mark is in the same unit with a gentleman by the name of Dan Lafferty. Very close. Anybody doesn't know what the name Dan Lafferty is? Back in the early 1980s, Dan Lafferty and his brother Ron developed, had their own school of prophets. They became very fanatical Mormons. They were excommunicated. And in 1984, his brother Ron received a revelation to kill their sister-in-law and niece, and then Dan carried it out. This is down in Provo. And Ron apparently attempted suicide one time, and he's sitting in the state hospital, whereas Dan's down at the state prison for life. About a week ago, Mr. Dan Lafferty took the opportunity to be on a local radio talk show, Tom Barberi program. And for those who are not from the area, Tom Barberi's been here 29 years. He's a very flamboyant and outrageous talk show host. And when he interviews people, he only does it about 15, 20 minutes. With Dan Lafferty, he took 2 hours. And one of the questions he asked, he said, now, understand, Dan Lafferty was more than glad to talk about himself, about his crimes, and he ripped on his brother Ron. He says, my brother Ron's the son of the devil, and I'm the son of God. You know, strange stuff. And then he said, Tom Barberi says, Dan, I understand that you're bunkmates or roommates with Mark Hoffman. And all of a sudden, Dan went, yes, but I don't want to talk about it. Mark doesn't like it when anybody talks about him. And he was not going to answer questions. But Tom kept going. He says, well, do you guys talk about your crimes? And Dan avoided it. And here's a man who would more than talk about himself, but didn't want to talk about Mark or anything he said. Having dealt with part of my law enforcement career with the prison system and correctional system, I guarantee you they have shared stories. And I sure wish I were a fly on the wall when that came down. But Dan Lafferty is being very respectful of the code of the prison system, which means you don't talk about other people. You don't squeal on somebody else. And it's holding to it. Now, I asked Jack Ford, what is Mark doing? Well, Mark at one time had moved up from a maximum security to a minimum security and worked in the culinary area preparing food, but now he's not back in max. Mark is not a dumb person. He has very high IQ. A few years ago, a fellow co-worker who used to work at the prison showed me some issues of the little monthly prison newspaper or magazine. And they had a listing of all the chess tournaments. And at the top was Mark Hoffman with about 3,500 victories. Next guy had like 25. He reads a lot about...
document?
It was a photocopy, what can I say? He reads a lot about coins, and if you remember, that's how he started out, and he reads a lot of law books. Now, if anybody know, any lawyers are here, Brent could say law books are the most boring things in the world, but he just reads them all the time. I think he's looking for a loophole myself, but I asked if he was trying to be a jailhouse lawyer, and Jack Ford said no, not as far as we know. He's not helping anybody, but he does have access to a telephone, a TV. He has visits from his family, his mother. His oldest son recently received a mission call, and he's been down there visiting him. His ex-wife has not been there for a long time. Requests by the media come all the time, Jack Ford says, and he always takes a trip down there, and Mark says no. About 2 years ago, we had the A&E program on City Confidential about the Hoffman case. And he said Mark's answer about being interviewed by them was not only no, but absolutely. However, I would encourage any media people to keep pushing the button, keep trying. Eventually, someday, he may just talk to us or talk to the media, but with the understanding that he may still manipulate like he did when they interviewed him following the plea bargain. I asked Jack Ford if when's his next parole date, and he says there's no indication on here, so it's at least enough in the distance. Hopefully, when that time comes, that we will not forget, and that what happens to Charlie Mattson in California is what they'll do with him, is the families will show up and remind of what he did and remind that he did not carry out his agreement on the plea bargain and did not come forth. In fact, if you read it, you'll find that Mark was very talkative, but when it came time for George Throckmorton and a few other of the investigators to come and talk to him, he clammed up and he did not want to talk to them. And maybe George can tell us during a question and answer period why that might be. Mark is just being cozy down there. He's being quiet. And probably the smartest thing for him anyway is not to do that, because loose lips sink ships. And he's probably said enough. So anyway, now let's go ahead and go to the question and answer period. And we'll just, hands are already up. Why don't we start with you?
Will there ever be a market for known Hoffman forgeries? And if so, can we then expect forgeries of
the question was, is there a market for Mark Hoffman forgeries?
Let me answer that question.
Jump in there.
Yeah.
Can I use this one?
I think I'm the only one here that could answer that, maybe.
I can, too.
Can you? Okay. Well, I know I can. I've been collecting for about 40 years now, and there are some very famous forgers that have done some magnificent forgeries in the past. Robert Spring, he used to do a number of forgeries of Lincoln and Washington and other great men. Joseph Cosey was one of the great ones from the 19th century. Did an entire rough draft in Jefferson's handwriting, quote unquote, of the Declaration of Independence, which incidentally came up for sale a few years ago. A magnificent piece of work, famous, sold for $500. And William Henry Ireland, who was famous in the 1700s for forging Shakespeare plays. Well, which is nice. We know of six Shakespeare signatures, and there are no plays that we're aware of in his handwriting. So you can get a Henry Ireland signature or part of his work from 200 years ago for under $500, usually $200-$300. They'll show up. Is there a... How'd you put your question? Will there ever be a market? I sure hope so. But but I've done everything I could to try to create one since he went to prison, and I think not. Frankly, I think people. It'll be a footnote. It'll be interesting, but people move on, and there'll be other forgers come around.
However, there is a fool born every minute. The enthusiasm I have for this matter, and seeing that George has one and Brent has a few, I went out yesterday and bought a Mark Hoffman from a local book dealer. This is the Sidney Rigdon Solomon Spaulding land deed, which was one of the poorer forgeries, if I remember, because he made some changes. But it is, as you can see at the bottom, there's the court docket, and was one of the items, and little where they tore off a part of the page to examine it. So you can come up and look at it. You can't touch it, but you can look at it. So, I spent so much for it. I'm not going to get into that because the minute I walked out, I felt like a fool. But I'm going to hold on to history for a while, and then hopefully somebody will be just as foolish and say, "I want that." And like Brent says, hopefully it will be a market. You had a question here. Yeah, please.
My name is Barnard Silver. I bought the Emma Smith hymnal from our friend Mark 3 months before the bombs went off. And, George, I think that was one of the first documents that you sent. When I received it, I saw that a back page seemed to be Xeroxed, and I began questioning that. I am like Brent, that I suffered financially very badly from that. But I would like to pay tribute this afternoon to Kurt Bench, who was working at Deseret Book. And I had purchased through Deseret Book some items that were Mark Hoffman's signatures. And I was extremely proud of our fellow Sunstone member, Kurt Bench, that he was most cooperative to get to the bottom of the forgeries. And Brent, if you have any comments that you want to make, but I am very sorry that Kurt Bench is not here, and I think we all need to pray for him and his rapid recovery. He had an aneurysm of the heart and was in surgery for about 6 hours, and I haven't heard the full report.
He's looking good.
Thank you.
Doctors are very happy.
Maybe I could just say on that, Bernard, thanks. I called yesterday to Kurt because I wanted to just get his advice, and also we've collected together for years and are old friends, too. And I was shocked to hear that he was in the hospital. But I did hear this morning that he's doing very, very well. I understand that that he had actually his aorta exploded inside the heart. And if it had been outside, I was told he would have been gone. But because it was inside, they were able to get him to the hospital in time, and he's doing extremely well. In fact, I heard today he's already asked for people from his company to come over and take notes and so on. So
he's already written instructions for his son how to run the business already, you know.
Yeah. So I'm grateful for that.
Yes, you first, then you.
I can answer that. Not only did he read books and talk to people, but when he was asked that question by one of the attorneys, he turned to the attorney and he said, "You're a lawyer. You've studied, you've practiced. That's what you do for a living." He said, "I'm a forger. I study, I practice. That's what I do for a living." And that's how he got good.
Could I just say here, I was always surprised that by some of the forgeries later on, after we knew they were forgeries, because some of the forgeries were of signatures which were fairly common years ago, such as George Buchanan, Joseph F. Smith, people like that, as well as the big name LDS signatures. And at any rate, I asked the prosecutors in the case if they would ask him about that, and they did. And the response that I was told they got back was, "Well, if my wife needed a bag of groceries for $40, I did a $40 signature. And if she needed a new roof for the house, I did a couple $1,000 signature." And that was the response. I thought it was quite interesting.
I want to throw something in here, and it's been fun looking at this. There's a big market out there for autographs and documents like this. I have a couple magazines here. One's Autograph Collector, one's a gallery. This is from the Gallery of History. They've got shops all around the country. I remember picking this up when I lived in Denver back in the 80s. And Gallery of History is great. They'll get a signature, and they'll a signature of somebody, say Brigham Young, and then they'll put a picture up there in a nice frame and ask for a couple $1,000 for it. And then you know the signature, if it's real, you could get one for maybe $500 or something like that. And then you talk to these people who are in these galleries, and they act like they really know what they're talking about. But when you talk to people like these who know something, these people don't know anything, but yet they're out here advertising, trying to sell, have auctions. I look in this magazine, and all the ads are for autograph shops that are around the world, people that deal specifically with these items and what they're selling. And I see nowhere in here do they say, "Well, how do you guarantee that it's there?" And as you hear what they said, that sometimes we don't guarantee anything. And that's what Mark Hoffman liked to play on, the gullibility. And that's the one thing I think we ought to do. And I'm sure I'm going to learn my lesson about this, but that sometimes we've got to be real careful. We can't want something so bad that we're willing to part with hard-earned money. We want it so bad that maybe we need to just be cautious. I talked to a gentleman up at the church archives about what they have done in reaction to this. And what the church has said, we're not buying documents anymore. That's all there is to it. If you want to donate it, fine, but we're not going to buy them. It's not worth it. Okay, yes, you. Why don't you jump up? This may take us the rest of the evening just to answer that question.
I was in a stake presidency in Moses Lake, Washington. Ed Decker was coming in and holding sessions there, trying to get Latter-day Saints. We had the LDS bookstore called Silver Books in Moses Lake, Washington. Richard L. Bushman is my brother-in-law. I'm married to Cherry Bushman. As Richard was working on his book, Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism, I told him, because I was in touch with Mark Hoffman, I was in touch with Lynn Jacobs, I was purchasing books from them. I was purchasing books from Deseret Book. And so I went to Richard and told him about the Salamander letter. He was just preparing to publish that book, and in his good, scholarly, faithful way, he responded to me that he questioned the providence of the Salamander letter. It did not fit into what he had researched, and so his book came out 2 months later, if I remember, or 3 months later, after the bombings, while the investigation was still going on. There at the Silver Books, we sold more Joseph Smiths and the Beginning of Mormonism. And in the state of Washington, this essentially saved all but two disenchantments with the church that I know about. And so I attribute this to good Latter-day Saint scholarship and the general membership of the church having faith with their own testimonies of Joseph Smith and his work.
Well, this is an interesting question, and it's been one posed to me many times, because I had an opportunity during these 4 years, 5 years before the Hoffman bombings. I was spending a lot of time with the brethren during when different letters would come forward and so on, which we thought, all except for Mark, of course, thought were genuine. And I can say honestly that I think particularly President Hinckley and the other leaders of the church that I had anything to do with during that time, acted with the utmost integrity during a time when they were constantly attacked for hiding documents, for being deceptive in purchasing them, and for the effect of putting them away and hiding them. And I knew firsthand that that was not the case. That some of these documents, you know, they turned down. The most notorious one was the Salamander letter, which, of course, had the most potentially damaging contents. And they turned that letter down. It had been offered to me, and I turned it down. And the reason I turned it down was I told Mark that I thought it was a forgery. And that's exactly why I put it to him. And that was about the only time I told him something he'd offered me I thought was a forgery. And he says, well, what makes you think so? And I says, well, because in Mormonism Unveiled, which I had recently reread, the Chase affidavit had an old toad jumping out of the box. And a white salamander just sounded too similar to me. I said, it's probably an old forgery, which, of course, it was not. But that's what I told him. And his response, Hoffman's response to me was, he says, it's genuine. And there were three reasons it was genuine. One was that Dean Jesse, the church authenticator at the time, would say that it's authentic. And the second one was that Ken Rendell, the man that had said the Hitler journals were fakes and got worldwide publicity out of that, would say it was genuine. And the final reason it was genuine was it would, what's more, Brent, he said, it was going to make Time magazine. And all three of those things happened, and it was still a fake. And so, the point of the matter is that I'm not answering your question directly, but I think that's a little background information on that. And I just like to say that during that time that the church, for instance, hammered on on hiding documents and so on, I remember being told several times, look, we want our historians, since we purchased this document or didn't purchase it, but got a copy of it, to have an opportunity to write something up, to put it in its context and so on first, which we ought to be able to do. And I think they acted with complete integrity when dealing with someone who had no integrity. And that's the way I look at it.
Yes.
Archives.
Church has these items. They are on microfilm. They are the actual documents aren't accessible, but you can look. The gentleman at the archives who I talked to said they have two Hoffman collections. One are the items the church received or bought from him. Another one is material articles that were put together on him, and that these things can be researched. I don't know any reason why somebody would have to look at the actual document unless it's a handwriting expert or something like that, but they said there's no restrictions on looking at these things.
Steve, maybe I could say that after the thing was over, I told Earl Olson, who used to work up there, I said, Earl, between your 57 documents and my 47, we ought to put them together and create a Hoffman wing. And Earl didn't even crack a smile. I thought it was kind of cute, but he didn't crack a smile.
Yes.
He was trying to destroy testimony. I mean, that's basically what he was doing there towards the end. He could have forged Michelangelo documents and sold them at that time for hundreds of thousands apiece. In fact, we know I know from having worked with the prosecutors, and I'd been a prosecutor once myself, and I was of course a victim on this case, that he'd made a trip to London one day, which we didn't know about before, had gone to the British Museum. And those of you that have been to the British Museum knows that there's a great manuscript room in there of very famous world figures, such as Galileo, Michelangelo, Raphael, people like that, whose autographs are still there. Shakespeare, one of his few signatures is there. And so if he'd started on world figures, he would have made a whole lot more money. But the fact of the matter was that it wasn't money as his only object. He was also out to destroy testimony, and that's where it becomes a little more difficult to understand his motivations.
Yes, right there.
I have in my possession a published letter written by a nephew of the doctor, and it's dated
the
brethren
at Carthage.
Now, what do I do with that? I'm sure
that he wants. Gentleman said he had a letter from the nephew of the doctor who attended the brethren when they're in the Carthage jail. And his question was, what do I do with this? That's a good question. We laugh, but that's a good question, because you wonder how many people in the last 15 years have had stuff like this, and they go, Now, obviously those who had contact with Mark, or maybe some of the people who were closely associated with him, wouldn't be hard to figure out. It was fun this last couple months being around George with his 1830 Book of Mormon. And he looked at it and said, boy, this is a bad Joseph Smith forgery in here. This is real bad. And then he calls the guy back and says, where'd you get it? Oh, I bought it from Mark Hoffman in 1984. Well, it doesn't take a brilliant scientist to figure that one out. But what about these things that are there? You got a lot of options, you know.
Yeah.
And again, that doesn't guarantee. I mean, I guess your option is the fact that you can either accept it as is, research it, see if it fits in that way, and then present it to here. But again, the problem you have is, who wants to spend that type of money and to be told, uh-uh? That's a scary thing. I mean, I have an Adolf Hitler autograph that I won't even let him see, because I have this strange feeling he's gonna say, thank you for your check, and no, it isn't. So I'm gonna give it to his son to look at and see if he'll do it for half the price. So. Do you have anything on that to say, George? Okay. In the blue in the back, please.
When you learn a document state, did the IRS cooperate and then you write it off?
Sounds like a painful question. I'm wondering there's something behind that. Well, certainly, if you've got a loss, can establish that you purchased it as a genuine piece, and then you have a loss, then you, of course, the rules that govern the tax laws take effect at that point. You have to establish that to their satisfaction, which sometimes is difficult, but that's the rules are there for that purpose. So it's like a loss from a fire or anything else.
Lady in the green, right here.
George says he wants to hear my story. So therefore, my understanding was that he couldn't prove provenance on the letter, which is kind of like genealogy for those of us in the church. He couldn't prove it passed a lot of the tests and so on that they gave it. But this man that's sitting here, George Throckmorton, is the one that broke the case on that particular document. He'll have to tell you about that. But because they couldn't believe that, with all our experts, that somebody out here in Utah figured it out. But the oath of a freeman was quite a skillful forgery. I've always thought it was funny that he made more than one. If any of you know what this is supposedly the first printed document in America, predating the Bay Psalm book. And it's mentioned in the Bay Psalm book as having been printed about, about 1639 by Stephen Day. But no copy of it's ever been located, been found. And one of the fascinating features of that story to me was, because I was dealing with Hoffman on other things at that point in time, was that he had flown to New York City to a bookstore that's also a favorite of mine, Argosy Bookstore. Mm-hmm. And it actually planted a piece of evidence there, which he bought out of their book bin. And in order to get, he made that entire trip to get a receipt. An entire trip was made so he could plant a Civil War poem called The Oath of a Free Man and take it to the register and have them write it up. Now, I need a receipt on, I need you to detail that I'm buying this for $25 or whatever it was. Now, that to me is amazing that he would do that, but he needed provenance, see, and he couldn't get it. That just wasn't enough for Library of Congress or for the American, American Antiquarian Society? Yeah, in Philadelphia. So both of them turned it down. The second one for a much lower sum of money. I think he was trying to get like $1.5 million originally. So
we got about another 20 minutes.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Another story by George Throckmorton.
This is a fun story. I thought it was. And again, remember, all the details are for gray hair, but it's basically correct. He found out that somebody, there was an auction or something that was looking for the Oath of a Freeman. And so he researched it, and what I'm telling you is what we gained through the investigation and also through talking with him later at the prison, realizing that only about half of what he told us was correct. So we picked and chose those areas that we wanted to believe, and we believed them and disregarded the rest. You know how people are and researchers are. Anyway, so he hears about this Oath of a Freeman. Again, it was the first printed document. The council in, I think it was Boston, ordered a printing press from England. Knowing it was going to be the first press here in the colonies, they knew it was going to be a historical significance, so they decided, what should we put out for the first paper to be printed in the colonies? And they decided the freemen that were there, similar to constables and another of the free status people at that time, they had this oath that they took, so it was called the Oath of a Freeman. And they thought it would be appropriate. Historically, there's four different accounts of what was written in this oath. And so Mark flew back to the library in New York and got Xerox copies of all of the different wordings that were used, copies of the different books that were used, printing devices and so forth. He did a lot of research. In fact, in talking to him about it, he said he spent more time on this document than any other document he forged in 4 weeks to prepare this. It took him several trips back and forth from New York. But after he devised the words, and what he did is he took from the four and combined them together to make his own. So it wouldn't be word for word of any of the others. It would be slightly different, which was typical of what he did on virtually all of his documents. He would modify them just slightly to make give them an air of authenticity. He came back and composed the oath. He made a printing plate so he could print them. He stole some paper from BYU Library, which was dated about 1670, and he printed on that paper this oath of a freeman. He then went back, as Brent said, in order to give it the provenance that he was looking for. He smuggled in some documents to the Argosy bookstore. We call it salting the mine, if you know what that means. He did that frequently with the church and with other places too. He would frequently donate documents. In fact, on the Salamander letter written by Martin Harris, I didn't realize there wasn't any writing of Martin Harris other than signatures until Mark Hoffman came along. He donated several items to the church that supposedly were fairly innocuous, but they were insignificant writings of Martin Harris. And then when the valuable documents came, and the FBI says we need known handwriting specimens of Martin Harris, guess where they got them from? They go to the church gives it to them, so they're comparing forgeries to forgeries. So in fact, they were accurate, although they were wrong in the assumption saying the word they were authentic. They were right in saying that the forgery they examined on the Salamander letter was written by the same person as the forgeries they got from the church. So, I mean, it's a kind of a hodgepodge of confusion sometimes. But anyway, so he made up this oath of a freeman along with another document, and he smuggled it into this Argosy bookstore. And if you realize all these stores you go to, they have these devices now where you can't go out without setting off alarms. There's none of those going in. You can smuggle anything you want into the stores, and that's exactly what he did. And he brought these documents up. He intentionally found the clerk, and he intentionally said, would you write Oath of a Freeman on here? Because typically they don't do that. They would just write two historical documents or old documents or something. But he went out of his way to make sure they put Oath of a Freeman. And then he came back to Salt Lake, and he switched the oath that he smuggled in with the one that he's now prepared to sell, which very closely resembles the historical account of what the oath looked like. He went back to Schiller and Wapner, which were our dealers in New York City, and he pretended to be the typical Utah hick. And I've often speculated that he probably had some cow manure on his shoes. I don't know, but I have that feeling. Because as he went in, he gave them the appearance he was as dumb as a doornail. He didn't have any idea what was going on. And he says, do you have any idea what this is? I bought it over at Argosy Book. Well, he's going to the guy that's advertising in the magazine looking for the Oath of a Freeman anyway. And, the guy's sitting in back of him going like this, I'm going to take advantage of this guy. When he walked out of that store, he had $165,000 in his pocket. The guy had given him that money for the right to sell the Oath of a Freeman. The basis was, if we can sell that for more than $1 million, we get half. If we can't sell it for at least $1 million, we won't get anything. They expected to sell it for $1.5 million. So they now have the right to go out and try and sell this document, and Hoffman had no control over it whatsoever. They thought they could sell it for $1.5 million, but when they went to the Library of Congress, they were not willing to pay that much money for them. Through a series of negotiations that went on for several months, they still wouldn't pay the $1 million. But this document, if you think about it, it was authenticated by the Library of Congress, by the American Antiquarian Society, by the FBI, by the McCrone Institute in Chicago, Illinois, which is one of those that examined the Shroud of Turin to determine that it was made in the 12th century. The University of California cyclotron test, which is the most sophisticated scientific instrument they have for dating documents, which also examined the Shroud of Turin. And a private laboratory in Cincinnati and Dallas, Texas. All of these said that document was genuine. When I said it was forged, the New York Times said some two-bit hick from Utah is the only one that said it's not genuine. So that's an endearing. I like that. If you want to call me the two-bit hick from Utah, that's fine. I accept that graciously. And the way we found out, in fact, I talked to the people in California during the preliminary hearing. They were examining the oath, and I talked to them, and I says, be careful, We know it's forged, but we can't tell you why. We won't be able to discuss any of our findings until after the trial. I talked to him for an hour and a half on the phone, and in spite of that, they issued a report which said it's genuine. About 2 years later, I had a call from a friend of mine in New York City who was walking up the street, and he said, "Oath of a Freeman on display." So he went in to look at it, and the Library of Congress, or excuse me, the University of California, was putting on a demonstration of how they determined the Oath of a Freeman was forged. They had actually gone back and revised their report. I've got a copy of the original where it says it's genuine. Now they've got a copy of a report which says they detected it. But anyway, it was a series of negotiations that took place over more than 7 months, and they couldn't sell it. They could have sold it easy for $750,000, no problem whatsoever. But because of the $1 million limit, the people in New York wouldn't sell it unless they got that, or they wouldn't get a penny off of it. In fact, they would have lost $165,000. If that document were examined soon, every other laboratory would still say it's genuine. And the only reason I determined that it was wrong was not me, really. It's not that good. The investigators went out and found a negative that was found locally that Hoffman used to make a printing plate. And the question was, which came first, the oath or the negative? And I was able to, through a microscopic examination, to determine that there was a microscopic flaw in one of the letters, the capital letter M, where, and if any of you are familiar with photography, you know that you wash negatives. Negatives are kind of like a jello substance that hardens. And you have to wash them good to make them clear. They didn't wash it totally and completely. So there was a flaw in the washing of the negative. And that flaw in the washing of the negative totally refuted all of the other scientific examinations that were done. Now, if they were to do a carbon dating on that, and this is what I always think is fun, if you wanted to carbon date, if this were a single piece of paper, and if you wanted to carbon date it, you would cut a piece of paper out about this big. You would burn it up, and then you would come back and say, "Guess what? That was a genuine document." That's why people don't want to carbon date and realize it's a 100-year, what is it, 100-year error with give or take 50 years, I think it is. So the document has to be more than 150 years old to even be considered accurate whatsoever. Hoffman was wise in keeping them in certain areas. And again, you're not going to pay that much money. It costs a couple of $1,000 to do that test and then come back and say, "Yeah, that $1.5 million document was genuine." So anyway, that's my story on the oath.
Maybe just in closing, since I was offered many of these things and I'm acquainted with some that have not surfaced yet, I might just give you a couple of pointers in case some of you come up with one or two of them that we're looking for. There was a Francis Scott Key printed "Oh Say Can You See," the national anthem, signed by Francis Scott Key, which was in the same, actually Hoffman showed it to me in his living room one day. Next time I saw it, it was framed for $130,000 in this gallery in Las Vegas. It's disappeared since then. I'm not sure who has it. Hoffman took me to lunch once and offered me a Billy the Kid letter. I know that when we went through the Hoffman files, we found a whole file on Billy the Kid. So pretty certain that one probably wouldn't fly either. I don't know where that letter is. A number of Paul Revere items that he showed me that I don't know where they are. A number of Daniel Boone's. One of them we mentioned earlier appeared on this catalog at Sotheby's 3 years ago. But there were a number of them he did. And he did. One way you can tell on his Daniel Boone's, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them, he added a cute little survey thing up in the corner. So none of the genuine ones I ever saw had that survey marking grid in the corner. Miles Standish. It was a famous American autograph. The only one I've ever seen was a Mark Hoffman original, and I don't know where that went. In fact, it was on a form that he used for Jim Bridger, and there's a few of those that are missing. I remember when I bought the Jim Bridger note from him, this was just signed with an X, you know, because that's all Jim Bridger could do, except this was Mark Hoffman. He told me that this was the only one I was buying, But there were at least eight others that, we located after that. So some of those bridges are floating around somewhere. We could probably make a longer list, but those are some that I just recall that were offered to me over the years that have sort of disappeared. It's interesting to me, too, that while a lot of dealers did cooperate, and particularly locally, people such as Kurt Bench and others here cooperated fully with the authorities, that there were people out of state, such as this gentleman in Las Vegas, who did not cooperate. And some of the larger, expensive forgeries went through him. So we've got to be vigilant and try to get them off the market.
I like to. We have time for a couple more questions, and I have a closing comment. Gentleman in the white right here. Yeah, either one can. More than I got.
One of the prosecutors in the case told me when I asked that question that they could count on between $3 and $4 million as having gone through his hands, but that they could account for all of that except save for a couple $100,000 was my understanding. This was back at the time of the trial. So,
I believe Alan Roberts indicated he tried to do a money trail, and there was a lot more than that that he couldn't account for. And you don't know what he's doing with. Yes, in the way in the back.
Yeah, I just wondered if the different books that have come out, which is the one, just whether you think positive or negative about them. The particular one I was interested in was the victim's book, which gave the perspective of the church leadership.
Many of you know Al Rust. Al and I probably at that time, I think, had invested the most in terms of money over the years with Hoffman. There were a few others that invested a lot, as George and as Steve have made mention of here. But we got together one day and just kind of went through the books that have been written. And we kind of put them on a 1 to 10 scale. And the only one that we felt like deserved a 10 was Victims. We did put Salamander very high at an 8. But we did feel like that when it dealt with the church, with the church authorities and so on, it presented a slant which wasn't always accurate. And so we thought that Victims was a very important addition to the writings there. As far as Robert Lindsay's Gathering of Saints, we put it as a 5 in terms of accuracy. Robert Lindsay's a good man, not from our area. He wrote Falcon and the Snowman, and he's a good writer, but he did his best he could in getting familiar with the case by blowing into town and blowing out. And he did. We gave him a 5 on a 10-point scale. And then the Mormon murders, we gave a minus 5, too. I don't think I need to say. I didn't recognize myself in the Mormon murders. I don't know about George or anybody else. But
A second question that George can answer, but also, what is your opinion of the A&E documentary on City Confidential on the Hoffman case, too?
Time is almost gone. I just want to give my perspective on that because I was involved and I've written all these books. In fact, see, this is the best one because if you look real fine down at the bottom, you'll see my name. Okay. But I got to tell you this. They edited over 200 pages out of that book. And they went through at least 4 editions. When I entered in, the only thing I said is I wanted to help if I could and I wanted to make sure it's accurate. And I wanted to have a section in the back which related to the examination of the documents, which they let me, and so that's how I got involved. It was halfway through before I even started. But anyway, as they would send me the manuscript to read, and I put in my 2 bits worth, I would go through and correct it. I would send it back. The editors would send it to me. I would correct it. I would send it back. Finally, on the 4th edition, I says, I'm tired of doing it. I don't care. Write anything you want. That was my first experience in editors. And as a result, as I read through it, I find inaccuracy after inaccuracy that I said, okay? As I read through the Mormon murders, and I agree with what Brent said there, as I read through the Mormon murders, and it talks about meetings I had with President Hinckley and so forth, never happened. Just plain never happened. I wasn't there. And finally, the other thing I want to say, over the years, I've had a lot of people talk about the hiding of the documents, the fooling of the church leaders, and all this other stuff. When I got involved with this, I was so frustrated being what I considered a good Mormon and coming in contact with certain people in the church bureaucracy, which caused me to walk out on a couple of meetings and tell them I didn't care what they wanted. I wasn't going to do what they wanted me to do. And then I found out I'd been dealing with a lawyer. And the one lawyer I spoke to kept saying, it's my job to protect the church and to protect President Hinckley. And there was absolutely no logic in what he was saying whatsoever. Others that were there from the library and the historical department was telling this, don't worry, cooperate with them, let them have it. They're not asking for anything we're not willing to let them have. And he says, I don't care, they're not going to have it. My job is to protect President Hinckley and protect the church. And finally, I walked out of that meeting. And the prosecutor come running after me and says, George, you got to do it, you can't do it, you can't leave, and so forth. We had a meeting sometime later, maybe a week or so, with Elder at Dallin Oaks, who was an apostle then, and a former Supreme Court justice, and his former dean of the law school, I guess, at BYU. Suddenly, we got somebody that knew something about the law, that had the authority of an apostle, and when we sat down, he said, you can have anything you want, period. And from that time on, I had total access to anything and everything I wanted. All these secret vaults you hear about in the church, I got to go in them. They ain't that big a deal. Okay. All of these mysterious hidden documents, they don't exist. They're a figment that Mark Kaufman put in the press to make people think that they were there, and lots of times they didn't. And I know that because the church was giving me things we hadn't even requested. The church was total cooperation. And if you want to talk to me later, I'll give you my perspective, but it's too long to waste a lot of people's time on because it's quite involved. But I had that same feeling. Why did the general authorities or the prophet of the church not know that these were forged? My question has been answered totally and completely, and I understand why. And it's very logical and very reasonable. Excuse me?
I can only assume that they either prayed about it or got a wrong and prayed about it.
You're wrong in both questions. I'll tell you. Saying if anybody else wants to stick around, but they got to end the thing, and Steve wants to close up, and I apologize. If you want to stick around for 3 days, you can hear my theory on everything. It ain't going to happen. But anyway, all I can say is all of these books represent a lot of evil among the church. I worked for the police department, and I talked to some of the investigators down there that says the church lied, they didn't cooperate, and all this other stuff. Ironically, they weren't involved in the investigation. I was. And it ain't true. And I'll say it ain't true again. And I'll say it ain't true again. They cooperated all the way, more than we wanted them to.